jihad and slavery and terrorism and persecution, trying to understand these aspects of Islam, thought we should start off with the scourge of slavery. We all have heard about a lot about slavery, and the moment you want to get involved in evangelism, so many people want to bring up slavery as though it's something that Christians should be cowering back into the floorboards about and apologizing for, whereas we want to discuss slavery because one of Christianity's unique accomplishments is the abolition of slavery. This is an evangelical accomplishment. This is something that Christianity has steadfastly stood against and has succeeded in defeating. And the only places in the world today where you will still find slavery are in some Muslim countries. So we need to know about slavery. We need to know the history about slavery. And we shouldn't be those who want to shy away from these hard subjects. That's the essence of judo. Take the enemy's momentum and use it against him. And so when they come at you with all the force of, what about the Crusades, Inquisition, slavery? Wonderful. We're so glad you raised that subject. You fall on your back, put your foot in the stomach and send him propelling into the wall and show the wall of reality exactly what the story is. While an enormous amount has been written concerning the transatlantic slave trade, the slavery that went from Africa across to the Americas, that's what you call the transatlantic slave trade. Surprisingly little attention has been given to the Islamic slave trade across the Sahara Desert in North Africa, the Red Sea into the Middle East, and across the Indian Ocean into the Muslim countries of Asia. While the European involvement in the transatlantic slave trade to the Americas lasted for just over three centuries, the Arab involvement in the slave trade has lasted 14 centuries, and in some parts of the Muslim world is still continuing to this day. So most of the slave trade has been ignored through most of the American and European history and literature. We should look at the contrasts in the captivity between the American and the Arab slave trades. A comparison of the Islamic slave trade to the American slave trade reveals some interesting contrasts. First of all, while two out of every three slaves shipped across the Atlantic were men, the proportions were reversed in the Islamic slave trade. Two women for every man was enslaved by the Muslims. Because while the Americans are looking primarily for laborers, the Arabs are looking primarily for concubines. While the mortality rate for slaves being transported across the Atlantic was as high as 10%, that means 10% of the slaves died in transit between Africa and the Americas. But the mortality rate of slaves dying in transit across the Sahara and East Africa, that was between 80 and 90% died. So it's exactly reversed. While almost all of the slaves shipped across the Atlantic were for agricultural work, like cotton fields, most of the slaves destined to the Muslim Middle East were for sexual exploitation as concubines and in harems and for military service. While many children are born to the descendants of slaves in the Americas and millions of the descendants of citizens in Brazil, in the USA to this day, some very prominent positions, very few descendants of the slaves that end up in the Middle East even survive today. Because while most of the slaves who went to the Americas could marry and have families, most of the male slaves destined to the Middle East were castrated, and most of the children born to women were killed at birth, either having their throat slit or being drowned in buckets of water. The logic was, it's cheaper to get new slaves than to waste time that could be used in productive slave service having to bring up the next generation. So they made sure they would never be threatened by a majority of the slaves, and therefore they annihilated any descendants. It's estimated that possibly as many as 11 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic. Now, that's the highest figure. That could be an exaggeration, but it could be as high as 11 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic. But 95% of the slaves who came across the Atlantic went to South and Central America, mostly to Portuguese, Spanish, and French possessions. Actually, less than 5%, 4.4% of all slaves that crossed the Atlantic went to the United States. Now, that may surprise you because the way your professors and media carry on, you'd assume that the United States of America was the prime culprit in the slave trade, was actually one of the less significant destinations. However, At least 28 million Africans were enslaved in the Muslim Middle East. As at least 80%, at least 80% of those captured by Muslim slave traders were calculated to have died before reaching the slave market, it's believed that the death toll from the 14 centuries of Muslim slave raids into Africa could reach over 112 million who died before they reached the slave market. When added to the number of those sold in the slave markets, the total number of African victims of the Trans-Sahara and East African slave trade could be significantly higher than 140 million people. Could be higher than that, but it's not less than 140 million victims of the Trans-Sahara and East African slave trade. One thing that I noticed when I started to study this was the absence of Arabic abolitionists. I've asked Muslims in universities, name me one Arab abolitionist. Name me an equivalent of William Wilberforce, David Livingstone, Abraham Lincoln, anybody in the Muslim world who fought against the slave trade. Name one. Yet to hear of one. While Christian reformers spearheaded the anti-slavery abolitionist movements in Europe and North America, and Great Britain mobilized her navy throughout most of the 19th century to intercept the slave ships and set the captives free, there was no comparable opposition to slavery within the Muslim world. Even after Great Britain outlawed the slave trade in 1807 and Europe abolished the slave trade in 1815 in the Treaty of Vienna, Muslim slave traders enslaved a further 2 million Africans in the 19th century. And this despite vigorous British naval activity and military intervention to limit the Islamic slave trade. By some calculations, the number of victims of the 14 centuries of Islamic slave trade could even exceed 180 million. I think that's quite possible. Nearly 100 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in America, and 130 years after all slaves within the British Empire were set free by parliamentary decree, Saudi Arabia and Yemen in 1962 and Mauritania in 1980 begrudgingly removed legalized slavery from the statute books. That's how recently it was in my lifetime. Only after international pressure was brought to bear, and by the way, it's strongly believed that there still is slavery in Saudi Arabia, and I'm convinced it is, but we're talking about it being removed off the statute books at least. Today, numerous international organizations document that slavery still continues in some Muslim countries. In fact, America's Malcolm X wrote that in 1968, when he visited Mecca, he saw black slaves in the slave market in Mecca. Now, bear in mind that Mecca, downtown Mecca, is limited to Muslims only. They've got big signs in English and Arabic, Muslims only, non-Muslims, sign this way. You go on the bypath, you don't go into the city. It's pain of death for a non-Muslim to go into Mecca. However, Malcolm X, who was a Muslim himself, saw black slaves in Mecca in 1968, which is well after they'd banned slavery, but we know it's still carrying on to this day. Before the coming of Christ, the heathen nations despised manual work and are confined it to slaves. When Christ was born, half of the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. Three-quarters of the population of Athens were slaves. Slavery was indigenous to African and Arab countries before it made its way to Europe. Now, the way you hear it from many of these professors at university who profess themselves to be wise, but they're actually fools, you would think that slavery was something that was invented in Europe, whereas that is not so. Slavery was widely practiced by the tribes of the American Indians long before Columbus set foot on the shores of the New World. The way some have put it, all the tribes of the Indians lived in peaceful harmony, democracy and republican forms of government without any violence or any kind of crime at all. And all of this was shattered by the arrival of Columbus, who introduced conflict to the North Americas, which was never known before. This, according to the fairy tales, according to the modern Grimm brothers. But slavery in Ethiopia was only abolished in 1942 when the South African army liberated Addis Ababa from the Italian fascists. Until the Italian conquest, slavery was on the statute books in Ethiopia. It was only because the South Africans forced them to abolish slavery in Ethiopia that it was abolished in 1942. Saudi Arabia had it till 1962 when America forced it to at least publicly remove it. Peru had slavery on the statute books till 1968. India till 1976. Mauritania till 1980, and it's still being practiced there without a shadow of a doubt. What is also seldom remembered is that many black Americans in the 19th century owned slaves. For example, according to the United States Census of 1830, in just one town of Charleston, South Carolina, 407 black Americans in that one town owned slaves themselves. The slavery is not just racial. We need to know the Christian roots of liberty. Jesus revolutionized labor by taking up the axe and the saw and the hammer and the plane. Our Lord endued labor with a new dignity. Christianity undercuts slavery by giving dignity to work. If Jesus could take up the towel and the bowl and start to clean the disciples' feet, and if Jesus could do hard labor, such as being a carpenter who couldn't order the plywood to be delivered, I mean, he had to go out there and chop down the trees. Pretty hard work being a carpenter. Christianity undercuts slavery. Because if work is having a dignity, the Christian work ethic completely undermined the whole rationale for slavery. By reforming work, Christianity gave work a new dignity and transformed the entire social order. Our Lord Jesus Christ began his ministry in Nazareth with these words from Luke 4:18. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and release to the oppressed. When the Apostle Paul wrote to Philemon concerning his escaped slave, he urged him to welcome back Onesimus, no longer as a slave, but as a brother, beloved in the Lord. Now that was revolutionary words. This animated tool is a brother in the Lord. Because of these and many other scriptural commands to love your neighbor, to be a good Samaritan, to do to others what you'd want them to do for you, Christians like William Wilberforce and John Newton and William Carey and David Livingston and Lord Shaftesbury and General Charles Gordon worked tirelessly to end the slave trade, to stop child slave labor, and to set the captives free. This is our Christian heritage. From the very beginning of the Christian church, Christians freed slaves. During the second and the third centuries, many tens of thousands of slaves were freed by people who were converted to Christ. Saint Melina was said to have emancipated 8,000 slaves. Saint Ovidus freed 5,000. Chromatius freed 1,400. Hermes, 1,200. Maybe they inherited the slaves. Maybe they owned them and then they were converted. Sometimes they bought slaves from others in order to set them free. Many of the Christian clergy at Hippo under St. Augustine freed their slaves as an act of piety. Remember, in the Roman Empire, slavery was pervasive. In AD 315, the Emperor Constantine, just 2 years after he had issued the Edict of Milan legalizing Christianity, imposed a death penalty on those who stole children to bring them up as slaves. So slave raiding, kidnapping, had the death penalty for the first time in history. The Emperor Justinian abolished all laws that prevented the freeing of slaves. St. Augustine saw slavery as a product of sin and contrary to God's divine plan in his book, The City of God. St. Chrysostom, the golden mouth, the greatest preacher of the Byzantine Empire in Constantinople, the pastor of the Hagia Sophia, he taught that when Christ came, he annulled slavery. He proclaimed that in Christ Jesus there is no slave. Therefore, it is not necessary to have a slave. Buy them. And after you've taught them some skill by which they can maintain themselves, set them free. For centuries, throughout the Middle Ages, bishops and church councils recommended redemption of captive slaves. And for five centuries, the Trinitarian monks redeemed Christian slaves from the Moorish or Muslim servitude, trying to set them free. In 1102, that's 900 years ago, the London Church Council outlawed slavery in England and outlawed the slave trade. By the 12th century, slaves in Europe were rare. And by the 14th century, slavery was almost unknown on the European continent. But then we need to look at the Islamic slave trade. With the birth of Islam came a rebirth of the slave trade, which had been going extinct through the influence of Christianity. As even Ronald Segal in Islam's Black Slaves documents, and Ronald Segal is no friend of Christianity and he's no enemy of Islam at all. He documents when Islam conquered the Persian Sassanid Empire and much of the Byzantine Empire, including Syria and Egypt in the 7th century, Islam acquired immense quantities of gold by stripping churches and monasteries, either directly or by taxes, payable in gold, imposed on the clergy, and looting gold from tombs. The state encouraged a search and sanctioned the seizure in return for a fifth of the fines, which was Muhammad's law. You can loot whatever you want, just make sure 20% comes to me. And that's where the great tombs and pyramids of Egypt were looted from. It was the Muslims who came in. I mean, this is an open secret amongst historians. They speak about these anonymous tomb robbers. Well, it was all the Muslims when they invaded Egypt. They had no respect for the dead. They looted the tombs, and that's where we lost so many priceless artifacts from the Arab invasion of Egypt. Segal notes that female slaves were required in considerable numbers for musicians, singers, and dancers. Many more were bought for domestic workers. Many were in demand as concubines. The harems of rulers could be enormous. The harem of Abdul Rahman III in Cordoba contained over 6,000 concubines, and one in the Fatimid palace in Cairo had twice as many concubines. Islam's black slaves also reveals that the castration of male slaves was commonplace. The Khalifa in Baghdad at the beginning of the 10th century had 7,000 black eunuchs and 4,000 white eunuchs in his palace. It is noted that there was widespread homosexual relations as well. Islam's black slaves notes that Islamic teachers throughout the centuries consistently defended slavery, for there must be masters and slaves, Islam taught. Just in the 19th century, for which we have the most accurate records, because they're closest to us, 1.2 million slaves were brought across the Sahara into the Middle East, 450,000 down the Red Sea, and 442,000 from East African coastal ports, like Zanzibar and Dar es Salaam. That's a total of 2 million black slaves just in the 1800s, as at least 8 million died before reaching Islamic slave markets. We're talking about 10 million victims just in the 1800s. Islam's black slaves records in the 1570s a Frenchman visiting Egypt found many thousands of blacks on sale in Cairo on market days. In 1665, Father Antonius Gonzalez, a Spanish-Belgian traveler, reported 800 to 1,000 slaves on sale in Cairo in the market day on any single day. In 1796, a British traveler reported a caravan of 5,000 slaves departing from Darfur, which is still much in the news today. In 1838, it was estimated that 10,000 to 12,000 slaves were arriving in Cairo every year. Just in the Arabic plantations of the east coast of Africa on the islands of Zanzibar and Pemba, there were 769,000 black slaves. In the 19th century, the East African black slave trade included 347,000 slaves shipped to Arabia, to Persia, and to India. 95,000 slaves were shipped to the Arab plantations in the Mascarim Islands. One caravan with 3,000 slaves proceeding from the coast in East Africa lost two-thirds of their number from starvation, disease, and murder. In the Nubian desert, one slave caravan of 2,000 slaves literally vanished as every single slave died en route to the market. Not one reached it. An eyewitness account from the 19th century. In 1818, Captain Lyon of the Royal Navy of Great Britain reported that the Al-Makani in Tripoli waged war on all of its defenseless neighbors and annually carried off 4,000 to 5,000 slaves. A piteous spectacle. These poor oppressed beings were, many of them, so exhausted as to scarcely be able to walk. Their legs and their feet were much swelled, and by their enormous size formed a striking contrast with their emaciated bodies. They were all borne down with loads of firewood, and even poor little children, worn to skeletons by fatigue and hardships, were obliged to bring and bear their burden, while many of their inhuman masters, with dreadful whips suspended from their waist, all the traders speak of the slaves as farmers do of cattle. The defenseless state of the Negro kingdoms to the southward are temptations too strong to be resisted. A force is therefore annually sent to pillage these defenseless people, to carry them off as slaves, to burn their towns, to kill the aged, to kill the infants, to destroy their crops, to inflict on them every possible misery. All slavery is for an unlimited time, and none of the owners ever moved without their whips, which were in constant use. Drinking too much water, bringing too little wood, or falling asleep before the cooking was finished were all considered nearly capital crimes. And it was in vain for these poor creatures to plead the excuse of being tired. Nothing could withstand the application of the whip. Records in Morocco in 1876 show that the market price for slaves varied from £10 to £30. Female slaves comprised the vast majority of sales, with attractive virgins fetching between £40 and £80. It was reported that a considerable number of the slaves crossing the Sahara were destined to become concubines in North Africa, the Middle East, and occasionally even further afield. Now, what may surprise many people is the existence of many Christian slaves to these Muslim masters. Segal, in Islam's Black Slaves, also observed that white slaves from Christian Spain, Central and Eastern Europe were also shipped into the Middle East and served in the palaces of the rulers and establishments of the rich. In fact, the very word slave comes from the word Slav, the people of Eastern Europe. I mean, they were the first of the large amount of slaves for the Roman Empire. So the very word slave has an origin from Eastern Europe, the Slavs. Segal records that all Slavic units are castrated in that region, and the operation is performed by Jewish merchants. Historian Robert Davis, in his book, Christian Slaves, Muslim Masters, White Slavery in the Mediterranean, the Barbary Coast, and India, and Italy, he estimates that the North African Muslim pirates abducted and enslaved more than 1 million Europeans between 1530 and 1780. These white Christians were seized in a series of raids which depopulated coastal towns from Sicily to Cornwall. Thousands of white Christians in coastal areas were seized every year to work as galley slaves, rowing the boats, laborers, and concubines for Muslim slave masters in what is today Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya. Villages and towns on the coast of Italy, Spain, Portugal, France were the hardest hit. But the Muslim slave raiders even seized people as far afield as Britain, Ireland, and Iceland. They even captured 130 American seamen from ships they boarded in the Atlantic between 1785 and 1793. I believe that recently an American congressman sweared in on a Quran, which he borrowed from the library of Thomas Jefferson. He said, "This Quran, which Thomas Jefferson turned to for spiritual enlightenment, oh, give us a break." Thomas Jefferson had a copy of the Quran for the same reason that FDR may have had a copy of Mein Kampf, to understand his enemy better, because American seamen were being kidnapped by the Barbary pirates, and he wanted to know what inspired these jihadists before sending the Marines into the shores of Tripoli. According to one report, 7,000 English people were abducted between 1622 to 1644, many of them ship passengers and crews. But the corsairs also landed on unguarded beaches, often at night, to snatch the unwary. Almost all the inhabitants of the island, the village of Baltimore in Ireland, were captured in 1631. And there were other raids in Devon and Cornwall. These are some things that led to the absolute outrage of the English Puritans against the pathetic, inept government of Charles I, and also were some of the causes for the English Civil War, because the king was not protecting the people of England, not from the Catholics of Ireland, nor from the Muslim Barbary pirates who were raiding their shores. And the English navy was pathetically weak at that stage. So one of the first priorities of Cromwell and the Puritan Parliament was to build up a strong British navy, and they went into the Mediterranean and sunk the ships of these Barbary pirates and started to provide safety and protection for the English coastal areas from the Barbary pirate raids. That was just one of the many causes that led to the English Civil War. Many of these white Christian slaves were put to work in quarries, building sites, galleys. They endured malnutrition, disease, mistreatment at the hands of their Muslim slave masters. Many of them were used for public works like building harbors. Most of the great buildings you see in North Africa were built by Christian slaves. Female captives were sexually abused in palace harems. Others were held as hostages and bargained for ransom. Quoting from Professor Davis, the most unlucky ended up stuck and forgotten out in the desert, in some sleepy town like Suez or in Turkish Sultanate galleys, where some slaves rowed for decades without ever setting foot on shore. Professor Davis estimates that up to 1.25 million Europeans were enslaved by Muslim slave raiders between 1500 and 1800. It's extraordinary that, considering that less than 5% of all the transatlantic slaves ended up in North America, that the vast majority of films, books, articles concerning the slave trade concentrate only on the American involvement in the slave trade, as though slavery was a uniquely American aberration. However, the vastly greater involvement of Portugal, Spain, and France seems to be largely forgotten and ignored. Even more so, the far greater and longer-running Islamic slave trade into the Muslim Middle East has been so ignored as to make it one of history's best-kept secrets. We tend to focus on what happened in North America because the United States would eventually fight a war in part over slavery, and because of the enormous and vocal American opposition to slavery, which was in sharp contrast to the indifference of Muslims and many Europeans towards it. I mean, how much do you find the slave trade issue being raised in Cuba or Brazil or Portugal or Spain? They were far more involved. But America is the most self-critical nation on earth, and that's, of course, a Protestant heritage, that we would be self-critical. It's better we judge ourselves. But that's why people have got a distortion. When you think of abortion, many people think abortion is a uniquely American crime. And yet, we have 7 million babies being killed every year in Europe, and 9 million in Russia, and 50 million babies aborted every year in China. And this is often forgotten, is that America's most self-critical, so we know more about the American involvement in abortion, for example. We know less about the hugely greater abortion crimes being committed across the whole of Europe and Asia. But what about the African slave trade? The legends of European slave raiders venturing into the jungles of Africa to capture free peoples are just that, legends. The embarrassing fact of history is that Europeans did not have to use any force to obtain these slaves. The slaves were sold by their black owners. There was no need for slave raiders to risk their lives or venture into the jungles of Africa. They simply purchased the people from African chiefs and Muslim slave raiders at the coast. Many chiefs found it more profitable to sell their enemies, their criminals, or their debtors, than to kill or imprison them. Many were weaker neighboring tribes conquered for the express purpose of selling their people into slavery. The disgraceful fact is that there were three equally guilty partners in the crime of the transatlantic slave trade. There were pagan African chiefs, the Muslim Arabs, and there were Christian Europeans, all involved in this wicked trade in human flesh. Mostly, African chiefs sold their own people or engaged in wars and slave raids against neighboring tribes to capture victims for this trade. Often, professional Arab slave traders provided the victims. A while ago, when they were having a United Nations conference in Durban, of all places, speaking about racism, and they decided to attack America and Israel as the only two places in the world where racism apparently takes place. And they were demanding that Europe, especially America and Britain, pay reparations for the slave trade. And at the time, I wrote that, in fact, you would have thought that England and America would be the countries that should be exempt from paying restitution because they already have. Britain abolished the slave trade 200 years ago and poured multiplied tens of millions of pounds into freeing slaves, into restoring and training slaves, into setting up whole nations like Liberia, just Sierra Leone for Britain, America set up Liberia, for freed slaves to go to, investing vast amounts there. And the English Navy for a century had as its primary object to free slaves and intercept slave ships and set the captives free. British Army stored many a slave stockade throughout the 19th century, setting slaves free. You would have thought that Britain would be one of the last countries to be asked to pay reparations. Portugal and Spain, maybe. France, yes. And many other countries like Cuba, sure. But as the president of Benin in Africa pointed out, he said, we would all be paying reparations to one another. He said, every one of us is descendants of slaves, and every one of us are descendants of slave owners and slave traders. He said, every tribe in Africa was involved in the slave trade. We all were guilty. And he said, if every descendant of slaves to get reparations from everybody who's a descendant of slave traders, he said, we'd all be paying reparations to one another because we descend from both. That there can't be a family in Africa that doesn't have both in their ancestry, which is an interesting perspective. The Middle Passage transported, but there was no mention about the Muslim nations involved in the slave trade of today. They're more wanting to talk about the slave trades of three centuries ago. The Middle Passage transported slaves to the West Indies. Here the slaves were sold and ships were loaded with spices, rum, molasses, and sugar. And the third leg of the journey was the return to England. The average Englishman on the street was kept in the dark as to what was actually happening on the Middle Passage, until in 1785, Thomas Clarkson's landmark study, Slavery and the Commerce in the Human Species, was first published in Cambridge, in Latin actually, but fortunately it translated into English very soon. And this helped launch Wilberforce's war against slavery. On Sunday, the 28th of October, 1787, William Wilberforce wrote in his diary, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of society. For the rest of his life, William Wilberforce dedicated his life as a member of Parliament to opposing the slave trade and working for the abolition of slavery throughout the British Empire. On the 22nd of February, 1807, 20 years after he first began his crusade, in the middle of Britain's war with France, extraordinary that in the middle of a war for their life, Britain could have done this. Wilberforce and his team's labors were rewarded with victory by an overwhelming 283 votes for to 16 votes against. The motion to abolish the slave trade was carried in the House of Commons. The parliamentarians leapt to their feet with great cheers and a very uncharacteristically British demonstration of the most emotional ovation ever seen in British history. William bent forward in his seat, his head in his hands, tears of gratitude streaming down his face as the English behaved in a very un-English way. In 1809, the British government mobilized its navy to search suspected slave ships, even foreign vessels on the high seas. In 1810, the British Parliament declared slave trading a felony, punishable by 14 years hard labor. By 1814, the British representative at the Congress of Vienna insisted on the abolition of the slave trade being included in the international treaty. This was initially resisted, but when Napoleon came back for his encore and then was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo, the British were in a stronger position to insist on the slave trade being abolished as part of all the European powers having to sign it, and all except Portugal did. 9th of June, 1815. So Europe abolished the slave trade in 1815. In 1825, Britain passed a bill making slave trading punishable by death, capital offense, because it was equated with piracy. Finally, just 3 days before William Wilberforce died, by an act of Parliament in 1833, the British abolished slavery itself, setting all 700,000 slaves in British overseas territories like Jamaica free. Wilberforce's lifetime campaign of 59 years was now fully successful. I thank God that I've lived to witness the day in which England is willing to give £20 million sterling for the abolition of slavery. Within 3 days, he died rejoicing. Now, for a fuller story on how slavery was abolished, we've got a chapter in The Greatest Century of Missions on William Wilberforce, Missionary to Parliament. That's on our website. And there's that excellent film now on Amazing Grace, which came out last year, released on the 22nd of February, on the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in the British Parliament. The history of European morals suggests that the unwary, unostentatious, inglorious campaign of England against slavery may be probably regarded as among the three or four perfectly virtuous pages comprising in the history of nations. And I think that's true. The abolition of slavery was one of the great turning points in history. And the long, vigorous crusade by the British Navy throughout the 19th century against the slave trade ranks as one of the most extraordinary and unselfish applications of national policy ever seen in the history of nations. Never before had any nation committed so much manpower and so much weaponry and so much expense to something that wasn't in any way serving their own needs. It was completely altruistic, it was unselfish, it was completely for the good of other people. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Now, Livingston's travels opened up a whole new understanding of the slave trade that failed to be wiped out. Yes, the Atlantic slave trade had been wiped out by Wilberforce's campaign. But now Livingston exposed the East African and Saharan slave trade, which was a whole different ballgame and even worse. As the British Navy was defeating the slave trade in the Atlantic, the East African slave trade was increasing. It was missionary explorer David Livingston whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. In his missionary travels, a narrative of an expedition to the Zambezi, in those two books, his first two missionary expeditions, they exposed the slave trade. Words like these. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry her load and the baby. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we saw it at the fountainhead. There, truly, Satan has his seat. Besides those actually captured, thousands are killed and die of their wounds and famine, driven from their villages by the internecine war waged for slaves with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered always, by the slave purchasers of Cuba and elsewhere. It was a trade in human misery. The British and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society reported that most slaves were captured in the Lake Nyasa area, Malawi and Mozambique, the Barrel Gazelle region of Sudan, and regions of Ethiopia. Slaves were taken to East African markets like Zanzibar and Kilwa and Kilimanjaro. They were shipped to Turkey, to India, to Saudi Arabia, to Yemen, Oman, to Iraq, Iran, and to the islands of Pemba, Reunion, and Madagascar. The anti-slavery report estimated that Muslim slave trade were exporting 63,000 slaves a year. Some estimates went as high as 500,000 in a single year. One researcher, Ralph Austin, calculated that between 1830 and 1861, the imports of slaves to the Persian Gulf area alone averaged 3,400 per year. The same researcher noted that an average of 8,855 slaves a year were retained as slaves on the East African coast as slaves of African slave masters. Now, very few authors dare to describe the horrors involved in the transatlantic slave trade. Kidnapping and castrating young boys to be sold as eunuchs, the living dead, in the homes of wealthy Arab landlords. Force marching young women across endless miles of scorching sand in the Sahara Desert to become slave concubines, most dying in transit. The Muslim slave trade typically dealt in the sale of castrated male slaves. Eunuchs were created by completely amputating the scrotum and penis of 8 to 12-year-old African boys. Hundreds of thousands of young boys bled to death during this gory procedure. The survival rate in this process ranged from 1 in 10 to 1 in 30. But it was these castrated boys who brought the highest price at the slave market. We need to understand Sharia law and slavery. Islam's black slaves notes that the Quran stipulated that female slaves might be lawfully enjoyed by their masters. Sexual exploitation and rape perfectly allowed under Islamic Sharia law. Muhammad himself owned many slaves, some of whom he captured in wars of conquest, some of whom he purchased. The names of 40 slaves owned by Muhammad are recorded by Muslim chroniclers, and Islamic Sharia law contains many elaborate regulations for slavery. A slave had no right to be heard in court. Testimony by a slave was forbidden. Slaves had no right to own property. Slaves could marry only with the permission of the owner. They're considered to be chattel, that is, movable property of the slave owner. Muslim slave owners were specifically entitled by Sharia law to sexually exploit their slaves, even hiring them out as prostitutes. That is written even in the Quran. One reason why very little has been written about the Arab involvement in slavery is that traditionally Islamic culture still condones slavery. You see, the whole base of Sharia is whatever Muhammad did, we must do. Whatever Muhammad forbade, we must forbid. Whatever Muhammad did, we cannot forbid or condemn. So they can never condemn slavery because Muhammad did slavery. He was a slave owner. He was a slave trader. How can they condemn slavery? They cannot if they are to be true to their Quran. The Sharia codified the Islamic law based upon the teachings and example of Muhammad's practices, and it contained explicit regulations for slavery. One of the primary motives of Islam is following the example of Muhammad. Whatever Muhammad did, we must do. Whatever he forbade, we must forbid. Whatever he didn't forbid, we may not forbid. And as Muhammad himself traded in slaves, owned slaves, accumulated multiple wives, even marrying a six-year-old Aisha, and having concubines, slavery and the sexual exploitation of women is deeply ingrained in Islamic tradition. That's why in places like Saudi Arabia and in Pakistan, marrying or having sex with minors is not a crime because of Sharia law. They can't make it a crime. How could they make it a crime? What we call child abuse, they would take as perfectly legal and acceptable because of the example of Muhammad. Slavery and sexual exploitation of women is deeply ingrained in Islamic tradition, and that's why I believe you're seeing more and more of this whole burqa being worn in the West, where the women wear these huge tents. We can't even see the eyes often. There's this screen over even the eyes. That was never required by Muhammad. That's not required in the Quran. They just had a scarf. This veil business covering even eyes, I believe, is a modern requirement because of our laws against physical abuse of women. And I'm sure that the primary goal of the burqa is to cover up the bruises and the black eyes and the beatings that the women have to endure. And so they've got to cover all their hands and legs to cover up all the bruises and abuses. And I see no requirement in Islam that requires them to dress in this way. But this is just a necessity in the West because of our laws against physical abuse against women. And so I think this is why they are getting more and more into this whole wearing the burqas even in the West. Muslim nations have engaged in the slave trade for over 600 years before Europe became involved in the transatlantic slave trade. And I should say, the lowlifes who got Europe involved in the slave trade were all enemies of the Reformation. It was Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, before whom Martin Luther had to make his "Here I stand, I can do no other" speech. That Charles V authorized Europe's involvement in the slave trade. It was Pope Alexander VI who authorized from the church's point of view. Britain's involvement in the slave trade started with Charles I, the very same one that Cromwell and Parliament had beheaded. It was Charles II who reintroduced slavery into Britain because Cromwell abolished it, of course. So it's the same enemies of the Reformation that got Europe involved in this low-life activity. And bear in mind, why did Spain and Portugal have such a leading role in slavery in Europe? Because they'd been controlled by the Muslims for hundreds of years. They learned from the Moors. And to many of the Spaniards and the Portuguese, getting involved in the slave trade and enslaving Africans was revenge. The Africans enslaved us, now we're going to enslave them. Of course, they got the wrong Africans, but many of them couldn't tell the difference between the Muslims and non-Muslims. What about slavery today? Almost 200 years after the British outlawed the slave trade in 1807, slave raids and the sale of slaves in Muslim markets continues in countries like Sudan. The slave trade remained legal in Saudi Arabia till 1962, of course. However, there are persistent, credible reports that slavery persists in Saudi Arabia, and even slaves from Sudan are ending up in Saudi Arabia today. Recently, a former slave from the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, Mende Nazir, had an autobiography, Slave, My True Story, published in London. Mende was captured in 1992 from the Nuba Mountains. She was first a slave to a rich family in Khartoum, and then in 2002, to a Sudanese diplomat in London. Can you imagine the audacity of this man? He goes as a diplomat to London, he takes the slaves with him. Well, she knew enough to know that slavery is not legal in England, so she conspired to escape, sought political asylum, published her book. This is up to date. And this we document in Slavery, Terrorism, Islam. How are we to deal with the terrorism we're facing today? It is no accident that the most vicious terrorism originates from the least evangelized area of the world. The Muslim Middle East represents the most complex political challenges and potentially the most enormous military threat to the free world. It also represents the greatest missionary challenge to the Christian church. Muslim states are the most severe persecutors of Christians, and radical Muslim extremists are the most vicious terrorists, hijackers, kidnappers, suicide bombers, and assassins. The failure of the Christian church to fulfill the Great Commission in the Middle East continues to have far-reaching and devastating consequences. Islam is a challenge we cannot ignore, yet very few Christians understand Islam or know how to respond to it. Back in 1995, Muammar Gaddafi hosted a two-week conference in Tripoli, which was attended by Muslim leaders from 80 countries. At this Muslim leaders' conference, strategies to transform Africa into an Islamic continent were discussed. The participants openly admitted that their goals were to make Arabic the official language of the whole continent of Africa and Islam the official religion. One South African member of Parliament, Farouk Kassim, declared it will probably be the biggest revolution to sweep Africa. The head of the Islamic Propagation Center International, Yusuf Didat, announced afterwards that South Africa was high on the agenda of the Islamic offensive. We are going to turn South Africa into a Muslim state, he said. We have the money to do it. At present, less than 2% of South Africans are Muslim. As about 40% of the population of Africa are Muslims, 17 of the 55 countries in Africa are officially Islamic states, and they all persecute the Christian church. What few Westerners understand is that Muslim leaders who call for the overthrow of all governments and the establishment of an Islamic superstate controlling all aspects of life for every person on earth, they're not necessarily extremists on the fringe of Islam. Jihad, the subjugation and forcible conversion of all people to Islam, and world domination are, in fact, central tenets of Islam. Jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. Well, I notice in America they often talk about the five pillars of Islam. Jihad was so important to Muhammad that he declared it to be the second most important deed in Islam. Remember, Jesus said the second most important command, love your neighbor. Muhammad said the second most important deed in Islam, jihad, kill your neighbor. Islam instructs its adherents to fight until all their opponents submit. Christians and Jews may be spared if they pay jizah, a tribute tax, with willing submission. Fight those who believe not in God nor in the last day, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are people of the book, until they pay jizah, tribute taxes, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued or humiliated. That's Surah 9:29. Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, seize them, beleaguer them, lie in wait and ambush for them in every stratagem of war. Surah 9:5. Therefore, when you meet the unbelievers, smite at their necks at length. When you've thoroughly subdued them, bind a bond on them firmly and slay them. Thereafter is the time for either generosity or ransom, until a war lays down its burdens. Thus you are commanded. Surah 47:4. For those who resist Islam, execution and mutilation is decreed. The punishment of those who wage war against Allah and against his apostle and strive with might and main for mischief throughout the land is execution or crucifixion or the cutting off of the hands and feet from opposite sides or exile from the land. This is an evangelist in Nuba Mountains that I took this picture of who had his feet axed off, no feet, chopped off at the ankles because he was evangelizing his neighbors. In the Mishkat, the rewards for participation in jihad is spelled out. The messenger of Allah said, to whichever village you go, it's one-fifth for Allah and his messenger, the remainder is for you. You can keep 80% of the loot, just give us 20%. The soldiers of Islam fought tooth and nail, we read in the Mishkat. They would get paradise in the case of death in a holy war, booties or loot in the case of conquest. Jihad is therefore the best source of all acquisitions. You see, this is the opposite of the Protestant work ethic. America got rich by teaching hard work, integrity, generosity, charity. Islam got rich by loot. Jihad is one of the chief meritorious acts in the eyes of Islam, and it's the best source of earnings. So much better than working for it, steal from someone else. This is the best method of earning, both spiritual and temporal. If victory is won, it's a tremendous booty and conquest of a country, which cannot be equal to any other source of earning. Better than hard work, I guess, in their minds. If there is defeat or death, there is everlasting paradise and a great spiritual benefit. This sort of jihad is conditional upon pure motive. That is for the establishing of the kingdom of Allah on earth. In the hadith, Muhammad is quoted as decreeing that a Muslim may not be punished for killing a kafir, or a non-Muslim. No Muslim should be killed for killing an infidel. That is why Muslims can kill Christians without any problem. You know, there was this case in Saudi Arabia where a businessman invited his entire extended family to his home to watch him drowning his daughter in a swimming pool. There, while they were standing around, apparently with a mother, brothers, sisters, grandmother, aunts, who knows, relatives standing around, the father drowned his daughter because she had converted to Christianity. There was no inquest. There was no charge. He wasn't arrested. There's no punishment for killing a couple. She had renounced Islam and had embraced Christ, so she could be killed in a swimming pool in front of multiple witnesses with no penalty. Those who die in holy war are guaranteed to go to heaven. The person who participates in jihad, holy battles, and Allah's cause, and nothing compels him to do so except belief in Allah and his apostle, will be recompensed by Allah, either with a reward or booty if he survives, or will be admitted to paradise if he is killed. Now, many people assume that the concept of jihad or holy war is an aberration, not truly representative of Islam. Some leaders of America have taught that Islam teaches a God of love, just as Christianity and Judaism. And Bill Clinton once said, no religion condones violence or terrorism. Unfortunately, that is just not true. Islam is no ordinary religion. It's more like a political system. Proverbs 14:12 says, there is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is the way of death. That you can write over Islam. It seems right to a man, but it's a way of death. Islam divides the whole world into two sectors. There's Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, and there's Dar al-Harab, the house of war. The only countries considered to be at peace are those where Islamic law, the Sharia, is enforced. All other countries, as part of Dar al-Harab, are considered legitimate military targets. These are graffiti opposite facing a mosque in Cape Town, death to American Israel. Just shows you the kind of peaceful, tolerant expressions that you find around mosques. Islam in Arabic means submission, surrender, or subjugation. A Muslim is one who submits. The Arabic word for peace is salam. Islam is the active force of salam. Salam, Muslim, Islam, comes from the same basic root, submission, subjugation, surrender. Muslims see themselves as a peacemaking force, using argument, intrigue, commerce, threats, terrorism, warfare, every other means possible to secure Islam as the only religion worldwide, which includes bombing tourist resorts in Kenya. This is the main daily newspaper in our city, and here is a mother in Iran strapping on a jihadist emblem on her son, that this Iranian mother has signed up her son to be a suicide bomber to go and blow up Americans and Israelis. Now, what kind of mother would do this? You know, I thought the maternal instinct was strong. And yet the Bible says, can a mother forsake her young? And we'd think, no. But the Bible says, though she might, yet God will not forsake you. Apparently, there are some mothers whose maternal instincts are dead. I mean, if they can go to abortion clinics, if a wolf could have more maternal instincts than that mother who abandoned the baby, and we've had wolves bring up babies abandoned in India, and of course Rome was built by Romulus and Remus, who were abandoned by the mother but brought up by a wolf. It would seem that some of the animal kingdom have more maternal instincts than some humans. Surah 8:39, and fight them on until there is no more tumult or oppression, and there prevails justice and faith in Allah altogether and everywhere. Now, in the light of these teachings, it should be no surprise to learn that since 1948, the 21 Arab countries have suffered at least 30 wars, 63 successful revolutions that I can estimate, at least 75 unsuccessful revolutions at least, and 36 heads of state were murdered. So, in the same time period that you've had one head of state assassinated, the Middle East has had 36 heads of state assassinated. But don't get too critical, it's about the only form of term limitation they have over there, apparently. In the Arab world, revolutions and assassinations have been the most prevalent means of political expression and of attaining power. One out of every three barrels of oil sold by the Middle East has gone to pay for weapons. Doesn't it make one feel so much better about fuel prices? Now, it may be hard for Christians to understand the concept of such a militant religion, but the primary aim of Islam is not spiritual, but political. Now, one exception to this might be the Sufis, the mystical Muslims who reinterpret the jihad passages to apply to a spiritual fight against sin. But even the Sufis, under the Mahdi, took the whole of Sudan and killed everybody in Khartoum in 1885, including beheading Charles Gordon, the English abolitionist. So even the spiritual wing of Islam is quite violent as well on occasion. The ultimate purpose of Islam is the establishment by force of a worldwide Islamic state where Sharia law is enforced on all. To achieve this is the goal of jihad. Islamic scholars identify a multitude of forms that jihad can take. Now, these aren't my designations. These are from Muslims' own writings. There is the jihad of words, using oratory in a war of nerves to inspire their own side and to undermine the morale of the enemy. This is what happens on Fridays at mosque a lot. There's the jihad of deception to confuse the enemy. It is perfectly acceptable to lie in Islam. To lie to infidels is not a crime, not a sin. In fact, it's required that anything necessary to advance Islam, even deception, is commended in the Quran. That's why to have somebody in court swearing to tell the truth on the Quran, they might as well swear on a copy of Das Kapital, Mein Kampf, Origin of Species, or a stack of Playboys. I mean, honestly and truly, there is no requirement in the Quran to tell the truth. The reason why the Bible is used in courts for centuries to swear to tell truth on, because the Bible contains the most heinous penalties for perjury. Therefore, to swear to tell truth on the basis of the Bible is a very serious, solemn thing to do, because the Bible condemns perjurers to up to the death penalty in capital cases. But to swear to tell the truth on the basis of the Quran, you know, why? What mindlessness? Thirdly, there's the jihad of the sword, to kill the enemy, to loot his possessions, to take hostages for ransom. Then there's the jihad of taxation on non-Muslims, jaza. Do you think it would be acceptable for America to impose quadruple taxes on your Muslim citizens in America, saying, look, because of the extra expenses for airport security and for defense throughout America and the wars overseas, and as it's because of Islam and terrorism, Muslims have to pay four times more tax than other American citizens. Do you think that would fly? Would that be acceptable? Do you know in every Muslim state in North Africa, they put eight times more taxes on the Christians than they do on the Muslims? And the Christians have never been a political or military threat to them. But whether you're talking about Egypt, whether you're talking about Syria, wherever you are in the Muslim world, they're happy to put extra taxation on the Christians. Now, you wouldn't dream of putting extra tax on the Muslims in America, although you'd have a justification for it. But they do it in the Muslim world all the time. And there's financial reward to provide incentive to converts to Islam. You convert to Islam, you get this job, you get this university bursary, and so on. Of course, there's the jihad of Sharia law, which degrades non-Muslims to a lower status, denies them equal access to the law because their test me is not valid against a Muslim. And non-Muslims' test me is invalid against a Muslim. A woman's test me is invalid against a man's. So, if you're a Christian woman raped in a Muslim country, there is no way on earth you could possibly ever get justice. Because the man just says no, and you get stoned to death. That's why throughout the Muslim world, victims of rape are stoned to death because of Sharia law. Because a woman's testimony is never valid against a man's. The victim gets stoned. The rapist walks. The jihad of polygamy is designed to give Muslims a disproportionate numerical advantage by having up to four wives at a time. And there's the jihad of the spirits, whatever on earth that means. Others have sought to justify the Islamic practice of jihad because they were victims of colonialism. This is quite a bizarre argument. Because the Muslim Arabs have been, perhaps, the most pervasive colonialists in all of history. Within the first three centuries of Muhammad's death, the tribes of Arabia, under the caliphs, had conquered Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Spain, Portugal, Persia, parts of Byzantium, even parts of France. The Muslim conquerors enforced Arabic as the official medium of communication throughout North Africa and the Middle East. Only Turkey and Persia resisted the policy of Arabization with any success. Arab comes from Arabia, Saudi Arabia. So what are we doing speaking Arabic in North Africa? Over 3,200 churches were destroyed or converted into mosques in the first century of Islam. The Muslim argument that jihad has always been waged in self-defense is therefore unconvincing. What were Arabians defending in Spain? The Christian blacks of southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains described their conflict as a war of decolonization from the Arab North. You know that more Christians died in Jos, Nigeria on the 11th of September than died in New York from the Muslim terrorist attacks. Because as Muslim youth came onto the streets of Jos shouting Allah Akbar and celebrating the news of this great victory of the successful terrorist attacks against America with the World Trade Center being hit, they launched into ripping. The first person died was a Christian woman who was pregnant. They ripped her to pieces and killed on the street right outside the mosque. And they went on, they burned down and destroyed hundreds of Christian homes and hundreds of churches and businesses. And thousands of Christians were killed in the vicious street fighting as the Muslims attacked the Christians. Many hundreds of churches have been destroyed by and thousands of Christians killed by Muslim militants in northern Nigeria alone. In the Philippines, in Indonesia, Christians, even schoolgirls, are beheaded, churches destroyed by Muslim terrorists. In Sudan, churches, schools, hospitals, mission stations, even ours, repeatedly bombed, aerial bombardment, and attacks by artillery and rockets by the Islamic government. So, what should be our response to the terrorist attacks and the ongoing jihad against so many Christians worldwide? Firstly, we need to recognize that this terrorism, this anti-Christian persecution, is originating from the least evangelized area of the world, the Muslim Middle East. The birthplace of the church is now the most needy mission field on earth. If we want to truly uproot the support bases of terrorism and implode the regimes that persecute Christians, we need to get really serious about the Great Commission of our Lord Jesus Christ. This will mean recognizing that we are already in a spiritual war. And the only reason why the devil is so often winning is because the church is so seldom fighting. We must not retreat into our barracks to sing our battle songs. We must attack strongholds of the enemy. We must not only talk about our spiritual weapons, we must use them. We must not only praise our commanding officer, we must obey him. And the best form of defense is attack. Now, civil government has a ministry of justice. Under God, they have a biblical duty to protect their citizens by bearing the sword, being an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. That's their job. Our duty in the Christian church is to be a ministry of grace. We are to be a house of prayer for all nations, preaching repentance and the forgiveness of sins to all nations, making disciples of all nations, teaching obedience to all things the Lord has commanded. That's our job. We have a unique opportunity at this time of crisis and warfare to effectively proclaim the gospel of Christ to Muslims all over the world. Instead of reacting with anger and malice, let us seek God's grace to reach out to our Muslim neighbors in Christian love. This is the time when we can openly and politely discuss the differences between the gospel, the example of Christ, and the teachings and actions of Muhammad. They want to compare Muhammad and Christ? Quran, the Bible? Excellent. We would love to do that. We can share our personal testimony and challenge Muslims to consider the claims of Christ. We can obtain and give out Christian literature, Bibles, to Muslims and our neighbors. We should invest in Christian radio programs specifically designed to reach Muslims. We should wholeheartedly support missionary work in Muslim countries. If Osama bin Laden can invest in translating the Quran into African languages like Zulu, he gave $1 million to translate the Quran to Zulu. And if he can finance massive print runs of Muslim literature, then how much more should we as Christians invest in biblical translations and Christian literature? By God's grace, our mission, Frontline Fellowship, has already distributed well over 250,000 Bibles and Christian books, most of that in Arabic, just in southern Sudan and Nub Mountains. We must do much, much more. We praise God that the scriptures assure us that the desert tribes will bow down to Christ, and his enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him. God will crush the heads of his enemies, of all those who go on in their sins. Are there any questions? Let me hand back to Mike for the question time, or do we just take questions straight from the floor? Thanks, Mike.